තස්ස භගවතු ආරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු ආරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතු ආරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස ඒසෝ වමංගෝ ධායති. So for this meditation session, we're now coming near to the more rarefied aspects of samadhi practice. And as the Buddha reminded us in the Mahasatchika Sutta, that reflecting on the nature of jhana and deep samadhi experiences, wondering to himself, like this sense of wonder, siya, could that be? Siya, it's a beautiful word, siya, could that be the path to enlightenment? And then this intuition arises, and knowledge arises. Oh yes, eso vamago bodhaya. This indeed is the path to enlightenment. So we shouldn't have any doubts about this path that we're on. We shouldn't be worrying ourselves with these silly little questions about should we be doing samatha or vipassana and all of these kinds of things. We should be listening to what the Buddha said. Eso vamago bodhaya. This indeed is the path to enlightenment. If we want enlightenment, then we follow the path. That's all. So for somebody who has faith in what the Buddha's teaching, then that's good enough. So in all of the talks so far, we've discussed in a fair amount of detail the preparation, how to develop the mind in that path which is conforming to or suitable for the development of peaceful states of mind. And of course, you know, I've said it before but must keep on saying it, that this is only a description of the path. It's only the words of advice and experience of those who've practice it previously and who've passed down their wisdom through the generations of practicing, experiencing. And to those people who compile the text, the sutta text, the commentaries, sub-commentaries, the oral traditions, the traditions of living masters who I've learned from, then all of those are just trying to help us to find peace and happiness. So we shouldn't make a problem out of these things. They're not a problem, they're just trying to help, that's all. And so we've tried to describe a path that's leading from an initial stage of just trying to get your bearings, just to get a bit of common or garden variety, sensible awareness, perhaps not all that common. And then from there, we discussed various preliminary practices that we can do, such as developing the four idipadas of enthusiasm, energy, awareness, and inquiry, and also doing meditation on the skeleton as another important, helpful practice. And then from there to develop metta for oneself, evoking the feeling of metta, keeping the word steady and strong, and making the feeling of metta clear and defined throughout the whole body. And then going to the second, metta for loved person, metta for the neutral person, and metta for the disliked person. Now, anyone who can really develop these up to this stage is doing very, very well. It's not common or normal that people will be able to develop their metta to this kind of degree. Okay, remember this, that the path we're doing is the path to awakening. Okay, it's not the path to learn how to do, you know, fridge maintenance or how to cook a silver jubilee cake or something like that. It's something that's very, very subtle. It's a distilled essence of what I believe to be the greatest spiritual path which has ever been discovered and described by humanity. So anybody who tells you that it's easy or that they can do it after just practicing for a few days and whatever, basically it's rubbish. Don't believe them. Okay? Of course it can happen occasionally that there are people who can do these things very easily because of their practice in past lives. Very, very occasionally. Maybe 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 1,000,000 of meditators. So I don't discount the possibility. But I don't know that I've ever met any. Maybe I've met perhaps one monk who fits into that category, one or two, who are now widely regarded as arahants. But I've hardly met, I don't know if I've met anybody else. I've met a lot of people who are highly deluded about what they think their meditation attainments are. And I've heard of a lot of spiritual teachers who get a long way by trying to explain the path as if it's much, much simpler than it in fact is. So I'm not in the game of trying to persuade you that all these things are very easy, that you can do a short retreat and realize them and so on. This is not what I'm trying to do. Okay? Remember that the Buddha himself had to struggle and often failed to realize these states. The great disciple, that Moggallana, had to struggle. Venerable Anuruddha had to struggle to be able to realize these things. They're not ordinary things. This is why they're called Uttari Manusa Dhamma, which are dhammas which are beyond the human, beyond the human experience. Alamariya Jnana Dasana, truly noble knowledge and vision. But of course, as the Buddha said, if it were not possible, I wouldn't ask you to do it. If it were not possible, I would not ask you to do it. The task is beyond anything we can imagine. The difficulty and subtlety of the task of developing samadhi is beyond anything that you have done ever in your life. It is far, far more difficult and far, far more subtle and far, far more refined. Beyond anything that you have ever imagined. That the other thing which is also true and is just as true is that your own capacity is just as far beyond what you imagine. You have the capacity to be a Buddha. We all have the same 5 khandhas, which is basically the same kind of thing. We're dealing with the same basic set of mental and physical potentials. And so, of course, the details differ from every one person to another, but the principle remains the same. The way of developing the mind is basically the same. Okay, although there are, of course, many variations. And so when you say to yourself, I can't do it, then you can rejoice in the word that there is actually, rejoice in the knowledge that there is actually a Pali word for this. It's called Niramisa Domanasa, a spiritual depression. Okay? So you know, oh, that's what I'm suffering from. Spiritual depression. It helps sometimes to have a label for things. It's okay. But you need to know that that's just the voice of delusion. That's just the voice of Mara telling you. So if you can reach to the 4th stage of metta, we're going along, we've done through the other, all the stages, we get to the 4th stage and we feel good. Mind is strong, energy is flowing. There's an eagerness for the meditation, and yet that comes, it's very cool. I'm not getting excited about it with, yeah, I've got a strong equanimity. And then we focus into the middle of this, what we call the nimitta. The nimitta is almost like the extracted, solidified essence of metta. That's the reflection of that heart which has been purified to a certain degree. And we keep on focusing on that. May that disliked person be happy. And we keep on going with that with excruciating patience, knife-edge patience. And no matter what happens, you don't let anything take you apart, even for a nanosecond. And you keep on going and finding that balance. And that balance becomes more and more apparent, whereas previously the balance might come and go fairly randomly. Now it's coming more, it's more flowing. And that balance is something which is like the sweet spot, that you hit this sweet spot where everything comes together with a sense of ease and it lights up. It falls into place. That degree of either application to the meditation, pushing in the meditation or falling back, you're right in the middle of it. The balance between focusing in and being broad and relaxed in awareness. The balance between the happiness and the rapture and also the equanimity. All these different kinds of balances come into balance. It's not just one balance, it's many different dimensions of the mind are coming into a sense of unity. This is what one-pointedness means. And then as you're doing that, the feeling of the body starts to fade away. And you're almost like you're seeing through the body. Okay, you're seeing the subtle dimension of the body, not the cause dimension. And as you keep on going in to that experience, it will become stronger and stronger. Now, one of the characteristics of this strengthening of the experience is that it feels more subtle. Okay? The stronger it is, the more subtle it is. And it's very much like this idea of, I have this idea like in Taoism, that the soft thing is the strongest, like the water is the one who will wear the rocks away. So in one aspect of the mind, it has that strength and solidity of rock, but it also has the softness and fluidity of water. And these are things which all seem like paradoxes when we compare it with our ordinary sensory experience. But the paradoxes all become resolved as we go into this unity experience. Things which, like it's bigger when we go into the meditation, it's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. Okay, so it's more obvious if you're doing breath meditation, you're sort of originally focusing on the nose tip, for example, and you go inside, you're pointing the mind into that small space, and then you go in there and it becomes very big, it opens out. Same thing happens in metta. You're focusing into the body, and as you go inside there, the mind broadens out and becomes vast. And you know those words that the Buddha used for meditation all the time, appamānena, mahāgatena, vipulena, this measureless, vast, exalted mind. It's not this kind of scrunched in little, you know, forcing the mind to sort of focus on one little spot. That's not samādhi. And samādhi is a mind which is very, very massive. It's like this sun of consciousness, which is just beaming. And as you go into that experience deeper and deeper, the nimitta, the metta-nimitta, will get stronger and more solid. The strength of it really, remember that the strength of it is the ability to suppress the hindrances. Or to put it the other way around, that the more the hindrances are suppressed, that the more solid the nimitta will appear. And that is two sides of the same coin. And it tends to happen in stages. Consciousness has this kind of discrete or quantum quality to it. In a sense, it goes gradually. It shelves gradually as you're going deeper, but it drops off. And so it'll like drop off in little steps. It's not completely even. The slope as you go down, it's got to go in steps. And when you go into these steps, then often you think that this is like the real nimitta has arisen. But all this time is still what we call the uggaha nimitta, the preliminary sign. That's what we call kanika samadhi. Now you can be in this kind of state for an hour or more, 2 hours, where the mind is very strong, very bright, focused on the meditation, very little thinking. The feeling of metta is, you know, fairly strong all the time, only a little bit of variation in it, and so on and so forth. And you can stay there for an hour or two or longer. And this is still only what we call Kanika Samadhi, like the first stage of Samadhi. It's not even real Samadhi yet. But if you keep going long enough, with enough patience, then the nimitta will arise. Technical term is the paribhaga nimitta. And the counterpart or reflex sign literally means counterpart. And that's, of course, a technical term which is taken from the Visuddhimagga. Now, that nimitta arises very powerfully in the mind and signals the onset of what we call upachara samadhi. So again, the technical term, access or threshold concentration. Now, you're now standing on the front porch. Okay, you've gone on a long journey and you're standing on the front porch. That's what upachara is. The upachara of this house is the front porch of the house. Okay, this is why I like the word threshold rather than the word they use sometimes, neighborhood concentration. But neighborhood means like the house down the road. That's our neighborhood. That's not what upachara samadhi is. Upachara samadhi is the step in front of the door. Okay, so once you reach that, you're very, very close. Now this nimitta appears in the mind like God. And that's really the best simile that you can use for the samadhi nimitta, because it can always appear differently. It can appear bright, or it can appear blissful, or it can appear coloured, or different. These are just perceptions. None of them are, they're all just the way that you see it. The overwhelming impression is just the power. It's the kind of unleashing of power, like these similes that's used, like when the moon is freed from the clouds, yeah, or when the sun is freed from the clouds. And you can just think of that, like there's this mind and it's just been obscured by defilements for so long, and then all you've ever seen is the cloudy sky, and then one day the clouds clear up and this sun is just beaming in. You know, and imagine if that had happened. Imagine if your whole life there'd been clouds in the sky, and now for the first time in your life, the clouds were to dissipate and you were to see the sun. Wouldn't you think that sun, that must be God? Yeah? And so this is how that nimitta appears. It's got this overwhelming presence that appears in the mind, and almost like it doesn't allow room for anything else to be there. And just this overwhelming sense of oneness and strength and stability. And yet at the same time, it's hardly there at all. And so this is again one of those wonderful paradoxes of these experiences. You can almost convince yourself that it's not there. You can almost convince yourself that this state of mind is perfectly normal. You've been like this your whole life. And you could just get up from your meditation and walk off and go about your business, and the mind would stay the same, because it's so natural. You feel like you're coming home. And again, all of these similes the Buddha used for the ending of the five hindrances, you know, like a man who's been sick and is free from their illness, or someone who's been in prison and they get released from the prison. There's no thing that consists of the state of health. There's no thing that it is to be free. It's just the freedom from those things that have been binding and oppressing us. It's a freedom from the illnesses. But the thing itself isn't anything. It doesn't have any essence. And so this is that mind which is freed from defilements. It's not anything. It's just a natural state of the mind. And so it feels as natural as pure water. It feels as natural as a bright blue sky. It feels like coming home. It feels like this is where I was born to be. And as you stay there, this experience in the mind, there's a slight difference in how you handle this in metta as compared to anapana. In anapana, in breath meditation, when this experience happens, you basically just don't do anything. You just stay there with, and just watch the nimitta, just let yourself go into it, that's all. With metta, you've still got a little bit of work to do. Now this stage of meditation, upacara, is still just on this side of absorption. And so you can still think. You can still move your mind. You can still experience things through the senses. Of course, you wouldn't. You wouldn't normally. These things are very attenuated by this time. But you still can a little bit. And so your last little gasp, if you like, your last little one job that you have to do at this stage in metta meditation is you take your mind out to experience the different, out from the body into the world. So you do this by simply allowing your mind to expand through the different physical locations. So from one's own body to the room, from the room to, say, the town or suburb that you're in, from the town or suburb to the city or the region, from the city or the region to the state, to the state to the country, from this country to the global region, and then to the whole world. Okay, and then you completely let go of the mind. Now when you're doing this, then you can use the words, may all beings be happy, or may all people be happy, something like that. And at this stage, because up until now we've been just dealing with individuals. So now for the first time you're starting to go to many beings rather than just one. And as you start to expand the mind like this, you really realize what this means. You really know what does it mean to actually say, may all beings be happy. And you realize that, you know, when you're doing your chanting, you do your metta chanting and you say, you know, may so-and-so be happy, or may so-and-so be happy, or may all beings be happy. And it gives you a nice kind of feeling, and you feel a bit of metta and so on. And you realize that that's just such a limited form of metta compared with what you're experiencing now. You realize that this is actually what the Buddha was talking about when he was talking about developing a mind that is immeasurable, that's exalted, that's vast, that has metta for all the living beings. And that mind has so much power and energy that it will, if you just have to suggest to it to go to expand outwards in that way, and it will naturally just follow along. It will expand itself out. The power and the strength of it will fill that space. If it doesn't, if the power and energy falls back, that means you haven't developed your nimitta properly. So you should do this more or less as soon as you're confident that the patibhaga nimitta has arisen. Okay, when it comes up, you know, to recognize it, you know that that's there, and then you expand outwards. Sometimes maybe you make a mistake and the power of the metta goes back and you realize you haven't developed it enough. That's okay, just come back, keep developing it. But if it works, and then the mind expands outwards, and you feel like you're just letting go of these shackles which you never even knew existed, and that expansion of the mind, it doesn't mean that you're sort of sending your mind to each individual person and trying to reach individual person metta. It's really like a radiation. You're just radiating it out. You can feel it like this radiation of light that's going out in these concentric spheres as they push further and further out until finally it's just radiating measurelessly. And so it's this kind of measureless consciousness which is where the attainment of samadhi will come. So classically, you're not supposed to be able to get jhana while doing metta for these four people, while your metta is just for one or other person. Now perhaps, maybe it would happen by mistake. I don't know. I never heard of it happening, but maybe it might. But normally, only when you've developed your mind to this immeasurable extent, then the mind will naturally go into samadhi. So when you've finally taken it out and just suggested, may all beings be happy or all people be happy, and then just letting that go, then just be. Then you just stay with that experience. Just let that happen. Not going forward, not going back, not standing still. And the mind just stays there. It does its own thing. And you have to totally trust it. Totally trust the mind at that point. Whatever it does is okay. It's letting it stay there. Now, often what will happen is it will just stay there for a period of time, and eventually the energy will fall back and it will withdraw. Typically, it might stay in that state for at least 20 minutes, half an hour, up to many hours it might stay in upachara state. But when sometimes when everything sort of comes together and the mind is moving towards unity or moving towards peace, then it will decide it wants to converge. Not you decide to do it, not that you make it do it. If you try to make it do anything, you'll ruin it. You don't make it do anything, rather you stop making. And it seems as if there were these activities, these sankharas, which were bubbling up or spontaneously appearing, but you'd never seen them before, and you'd never seen them until the moment when they end. So even in this state of mind, which is so strong and quiet and peaceful, the upachara state, then still there's certain activities in the mind which stop it from being completely one and completely peaceful. And you can't see, you don't know that they're there, but you just see them end. You see the ending. Oh, what previously was slightly more agitated then becomes peaceful. And as that happens, then the mind goes into what we call jhana or samadhi, apanna samadhi. Now that transition point between upachara and jhana is very dicey. You're really stepping between two worlds, two completely different kinds of dimensions of consciousness. And it's quite common that the mind will withdraw. It doesn't want to go there. I've heard that described once as being like bungee jumping. It's like you're doing bungee jumping down a deep well, and it feels like you're falling down a deep well. And just as you feel like you're going to hit the water at the bottom of it and go inside the water, then suddenly, whoop, there you go back out again. And sometimes it can be a very powerful fear, because you're actually losing everything. You're losing the whole world. You know, forget about giving up a meal in the afternoon. You're giving up the world, the whole world you've ever known, and you're stepping into a place that's completely different. It's absolutely terrifying. And so it's very easy for fear to arise in the mind, nervousness to arise in the mind. So these are two things that tend to happen, is either that one's a bit eager and pushes into it a bit, which makes it recede away, or that one gets fear and pulls back. And so because the mind's very powerful at this stage, you know, you can, even just that moment, like a flicker, like a flicker of fear can come, and then the heart will start beating and pounding, and one pulls back. So there's nothing really that you can do about this. One suggestion that Ajahn Brahm recommends for people who have this problem is, he suggests that if you do some contemplation of not self before you start the meditation, so just some discursive contemplation of not self with regards to your body, and just sort of seeing all the body parts as not me, not mine, not myself, let go of them all, And that's a way of like programming your mind to be able to let go of your body when you get to that stage. But really what does it is just, again, just that sense of everything coming into harmony and balance, and also just a sense of familiarity, of trust, that you know the landscape and you don't have anything to fear. And so when that happens, then you go through and that experience, it feels, you know, again, it's like perception thing. It's not, some people feel like going down into a well, other people feel like they're being sucked out. You feel like, it feels very, very strange. There's no words kind of fail you. You can't, the strangeness of the experience is, you know, there is, just isn't a language that's been really evolved to describe it. And, you know, so it's almost, you can feel like you're being kind of sucked through a tunnel or something like that. And, you almost feel like you're being sucked through a tunnel that's turning your brain inside out. And so you really can't kind of describe it. And then one goes into a state of, jhana or samadhi. Now, once, you know, you're in that state, you can't do anything, okay? There's no choice. You can't think or move the mind or do anything. You're just kind of stuck there in this realm. And I've heard it described as being like a realm of frozen bliss and light. And just being pulled out into this realm of frozen bliss and light and just being there. And so there's no time as such, there's nothing to measure or compare time with. There's just that experience of what it's like to be completely freed from the body, the happiness that comes from complete freedom from the body, not being able to experience anything. And the total freedom inside the mind. So normally, of course, you have the classical series of the four jhanas. And, you know, they are described in the texts. The first jhana has its, we call vitakka and vichara, the initial and sustained application, which is like a kind of, Ajahn Brahm describes as a memory memorably called a wobble. It's like a wobble in the mind. And, so there's like the mind's a bit like jelly, or again Ajahn Brahm described it, it's a bit like a tennis ball. The mind in first jhana is like a tennis ball, and the mind in second jhana is like a bowling ball. So that gives you some idea that first jhana is completely unified and withdrawn inside, but still a little bit wobbly around the edges. And that wobble especially is like the movement of the mind. The mind's completely unified with its object, but it will still kind of move towards the mind. Sorry, the mind will move towards the object and they're pushing it away. So there's this kind of done, this rhythm, or this kind of very, very gentle kind of ripple. As the mind's pushing on the object recedes a little bit. And the mind pushes again, holds, and as it's holding, the object recedes. And this is that action of vitakka vichara. It's just this very, very subtle residual movement of the mind towards the object, okay, at this stage. And again, you can't even see it. You can't even, you don't even know it's there. The mind feels like it's completely still and completely peaceful. And it's not until it disappears that you can really know what it is. Yeah? And then the mind becomes more peaceful, more still, then it just goes. And then the clarity, anjatang sampasadana, when that subtle movement goes, there's this sense of total clarity in the mind as one's seeing into this light. It's like it just clicks into focus, but you didn't realize it was out of focus before. You never noticed it was out of focus, but now it's just, oh, it's just nudged. And that slight fuzziness caused by the wobble of vitakka vichara has faded away. And one has the clarity and the confidence. This word sampasadanang means both clarity and confidence. One doesn't feel like one has to apply to the meditation object anymore. It's just there. And so one's just completely confident to be there, and then that gives that clarity because there's no movement in the mind. And so this is the rapture and happiness that's born of this total unity of samadhi. Then, as that experience then deepens, then you begin to realize that there's this kind of, there's this bliss in the mind, and that bliss is that one has this slight sense of excitement about that, slight sense of being stimulated by that bliss, as we call bhiti or rapture. And then that too fades away. And so one still has the bliss, one still has the same feeling of sukha, but one's emotional response to that sukha has now matured. It's turned from an emotional response of being slightly excited and thrilled by it to an emotional response of equanimity towards it. And this is what we call the third jhana. Again, it's not something you do, it's not something you think about, it's not something you could describe to yourself. It's just something that naturally happens through the maturing of the mind. Remember that it took a Buddha to come along and describe these things clearly in this way. And before the Buddha came, and in every other tradition that I'm aware of, the way of describing these experiences is just in terms of kind of mystical terms. It's oneness with God, it's oneness with the fabric of all being, or something like this. And that's all we can do, is to use some kind of mystical description. And so it took the Buddha to really see the subtlety of the mental faculties that are going on here. So please don't think, as I'm describing it, that, you know, you see all these two distinct things and that they're very obvious and plain, and then you think, okay, I'll let go of one of them and then it'll go away. It's just an intuitive natural process. So we just describe this intuitive natural process to give an idea of what to expect, that's all. Eventually, that feeling of bliss also naturally fades away. And we know that through our own understanding of psychology, that pleasant feeling, no matter how subtle and how beautiful, if there's too much of it, becomes cloying. And so that pleasant feeling was like, it's like the glue which is sucking the mind onto the object, and now that glue is like dried out. You know, we have that complete equanimity, as we call the fourth jhana, and it's described as being like pure, bright mind. Purified, totally purified mindfulness. So this is like the greatest strength of mindfulness is reached at this stage. So for somebody who's practicing, then of course normally they would, you know, once they develop their nimitta and so on, they'd normally go into first jhana. And it's not uncommon to find somebody who would go into jhana more or less by accident. Okay? And I've heard that, you know, of course, in the Buddha's life story, when he was a young boy, he went into first jhana. And I've heard in several stories of people who went into samadhi more or less by accident, but who perhaps weren't able to repeat it after that. And so this happens. According to the strength with which you've developed the meditation previously, this is what will determine how deeply the mind goes into samadhi. You can't choose once you're in there, I'm going to go into second jhana or third jhana or anything like that. It's just this kind of natural process according to the momentum you've developed before. Somebody who's mastered jhana, somebody who's practiced it many, many times and has got skilled in it, can make that determination previously. Okay, so they can make a determination to say, okay, I'm going to go into first jhana for 10 minutes and then second jhana for half an hour or something like that. And then they can do that. I'm going to come out of meditation in 50 minutes or something like that. So this is possible. This is not anything which is kind of particularly mysterious. And as Ajahn Brahm often teaches on his retreats, you can actually teach yourself to wake up, and it's actually quite easy, instead of setting your alarm, to just say, okay, I'm going to wake up at such and such a time, and then you find that you do wake up at that time. It's just a matter of training yourself like that. There's nothing mystical about it particularly. We just have an internal clock in our mind, that's all. And so this experience, jhanic experience, lasts for as long as it does. Okay, as long as the mind has its energy, it stays locked into that state. And when the energy of the mind declines, then it will naturally withdraw. So what happens next is what I'll talk about in the next meditation. So is there any questions or comments about the talks this evening?
I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful retreat and go to many, many jhanas. You should die.
Thank you, Eva.
I hope it feels for you as though it's months and months of bliss.
No, that's the problem, is that the better your samadhi is, the faster the retreat goes by. Okay, so let's do some guided meditation. So I'll take you through all the steps up to first jhana. So even though I don't expect anyone to really get into that state in this short amount of time, but still we just go through it just so we have an idea of what we're doing, okay? And then when it comes, then we'll be a bit more prepared, that's all. And sitting quietly. Focusing the mind in the heart. And bring up the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Keeping the words steady and even. Allowing the feeling of metta to blossom up and spread out through the whole body. feeling is strong and even through the body, move to metta for a loved one. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. Enter the neutral person. May that neutral person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. And finally, to the disliked person. May that disliked person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. And then letting the mind expand out from the body. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. Radiating outwards like a field of light. May all beings in this room be happy. May all beings in Bundanoon be happy. May all beings in the district be happy. May all beings in this state be happy. May all beings in this country be happy. May all beings in the world be happy. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. And then gradually withdrawing. May all beings in the world be happy. May all beings in this country be happy. May all beings in this state be happy. May all beings in this district be happy. May all beings in this town be happy. May all beings in this room be happy. And to the loved one, the disliked one, may the disliked one be happy. To the neutral person, may the neutral person be happy. To the loved one, may the loved one be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. may I be happy. And letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away, allowing the mind to come back to a neutral space, empty, open, and clear. Just taking a minute to reflect over that meditation. How did that just go? What did it feel like? What did it feel like when I was expanding my mind, moving outside of the body, radiating outwards? Finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings rejoice in the merit that we've made through our practice. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu. Okay, let's finish by paying respects.
Sangha Sangha.